Populist trade policies often make little sense to economists, but is it our trade models that need to evolve? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. We live in the age of Brexit, economic nationalism and calls for protectionism. This blows the minds of some trade economists, who point out that when people vote for these policies, they're choosing to make themselves poorer. In a new paper on trade policy, two CEPR fellows, Gene Grossman of Princeton and Elhanan Helpman of Harvard, have started from the point of view that what makes rational voters most content is not always the same policy that would make them most rich. Gene is here today to tell us what other factors influence their opinions and what happens when we include these factors in our models of trade. Gene Grossman, welcome to Vox Talks.
Hello, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Now, let's not keep the audience in suspense, Gene. What other components of well-being are you taking into account here?
Well, we begin with the understanding that humans are social creatures. On the one hand, we take pride and gain self-esteem from seeing ourselves as members of social groups. On the other hand, we feel discomfort from seeing ourselves as very different in some ways from other members of the groups with which we identify. So to answer your question, we simply add components of well-being that reflect the positive and negatives that people derive from social identification. We add a positive component that reflects the pride an individual feels from his or her group status. And we add a negative component that reflects the cognitive dissonance that occurs when a person sees himself or herself as different from a group's typical member.
Now, this social identity theory that you're using, it's a fairly recent idea in economics, but it's been around for a while, it seems, in the other social sciences. Did you need to rely on research from other disciplines to use it?
Absolutely. We read a great deal of the classic papers in social psychology. Social psychologists have given a lot of thought to the aspects of well-being that come from feelings about oneself, and especially from the formation of self-identity. They emphasize self-categorization, which features prominently in our work. Our paper is an attempt to capture their ideas in a simple, some might say too simple, stylized way.
As you say in the paper, you've added these components to a two-good, two-factor model of trade. Many of our listeners would recognize it. Was it hard to do this?
Well, in some ways, it was quite easy. Economists are used to assuming that individuals maximize utility. We took a standard trade model and combined it with a standard political economy model of the policy formation and simply changed the definition of what we consider to be utility. I guess the difficult part was deciding exactly how to specify the benefits from group identification and the costs of being different. Social psychologists tell us that these things matter, but they don't tell us much about how they should be measured or exactly how they should enter into our models.
And so how does it change the predictions that these standard trade models give us?
Well, our paper's about preferences over policy and ultimately how these preferences are aggregated by the political process to generate a nation's trade stance. In our model, without the identity components that we add, the predicted policy outcome would be one of free trade because that's what wins the political contestants the greatest number of votes. But by introducing social identity, we find it much more likely that the outcome will involve trade protectionism in countries like the U.S. and Western Europe that import goods from countries with an abundance of low-skilled labor.
One of the interesting aspects that I noticed from the paper is that quite small changes in how a limited number of individuals self-identify may create much bigger aggregate effects. How does this process work?
Well, in a world without social identification, such as most of our trade models, small changes in economic environment lead to small changes in preferences and thus to small changes in policy pressures. But when individuals choose their identities, changes in their self-categorization generate discrete changes in their preferences. If a person identifies as a member of a certain social group, he or she may care about the status and well-being of others in that group. Then if self-identification changes, so will their preferences about trade policy because they'll be changing whose interests they take into account.
Now, this is all theoretical, but how did you apply this model to the impact of the real-world increases that we've seen lately in populism and racial tension?
Well, that's a good question. We considered two changes in social identity that many commentators have been talking about and described in recent years. First, some working-class voters have narrowed their identities to exclude the so-called elites. And second, some members of ethnic and racial groups have narrowed their identities to exclude others that are socioeconomically similar to themselves but of a different ethnic or racial background. Our analysis is all about how this narrowing of identification changes attitudes about globalization and ultimately about the trade policies that result. When people change their identity, and particularly when they narrow them, they stop taking into account the interests of those that are no longer members of their perceived identity group. So, for example, when the working class no longer considers the elites to be legitimate, worthy of policy consideration, they no longer take those elites' interests into account, and the elites are the ones perhaps that benefit most directly in material terms from trade. So dropping them from their self-identification means that they will no longer care about the benefits that those elite members gain from liberal trade. Protection from imports from China, for example, tend to benefit narrowly the interests of those who are competing with the Chinese workers, but harm the country as a whole, and in particular the elites. So if the working class no longer considers the interests of the elites, it makes sense that they become much more protectionist.
But although this quite neatly explains some of the effects that we're already seeing, there, as you've already said, there isn't an easy way to measure things like pride or self-esteem ex ante. So how useful can your insights be for predicting trends?
Well, you're absolutely right about that. These concepts are very difficult to measure and even more difficult to forecast. We have some thoughts about using responses to social surveys, value surveys, and the like to gain some understanding of how people are identifying and therefore to predict how they might change their identity based on things like changes in the income distribution or changes in the level of immigration. But predicting the future of self-identification indeed seems a very daunting task.
Economics also has an explanation for where support for protectionism or anti-globalization policies has come from. That's the influence of lobbyists, special interest groups. You've personally done a lot of work on this. Do we have to look again at how important we have decided that these factors are?
No, I don't see it that way. In fact, I see the two explanations as quite complementary. Our work and others' work on special interest groups focuses mainly on which industries will be more successful in gaining protection in a world that departs from free trade? Why agriculture? Why textiles? Why steel, for example? Our current research is more about popular attitudes towards trade and globalization in general, which might determine the level of the average protection rather than the particulars of which industries are protected.
A social identity theory seems to me like it might have some applications in other areas of economics. Are you going to carry on with this? Do you think that other economists could take it up?
Absolutely. A key building block of economics is agents' preferences. It features at the first line of almost every model. And political economy is all about how these preferences are aggregated by the political system to yield a policy outcome. Social identity theory advises us to take a broader view of preferences than the narrow economic self-interest that economists are used to including in their models. So one could fruitfully think about tax policy, spending policy, education policy, any sort of policy that affects one's own material well-being but also affects others in the groups with which one identifies. So I think that introducing social identity theory into political economy has broad applications, and we certainly are hoping in some of our near-term work to think, for example, about immigration policy, where this seems to feature prominently.
With hindsight, Gene, has economics missed a trick on this?
Economics broadly has been introducing more behavioral components in all aspects of individual reasoning and decisions about what to buy and where to work and the like. So I think we're coming along. I think that it's easy to think about what a person's narrow self-interest is. It's a little harder to think about how they choose to identify, which groups they choose to identify, which groups are salient in a moment in political history. So I think we'll get there.
Well, I'll be looking out for the other work that's coming along. Thank you, Gene Grossman.
And thanks, Tim.
If you want to dig deeper into this, the title of the paper is Identity Politics and Trade Policy. It's CEPR discussion paper 13367. It's not long, but it's certainly thought-provoking. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. There's a new episode every Friday, so if you subscribe on your podcast platform, you'll get updates. Let us know if there's a topic you want us to cover, and tell your friends about us. You can also find our archive at www.voxeu.org/vox-talks.